and combine our interests in biological control and general public adult education to see if we can come up with a way to get people to replace their pesticide use with some other alternatives. So our objectives were to reduce pesticide uses. We wanted to maybe give some guidelines to help gardens, people design gardens to minimize their pest problems, use tactics that enhance and don't disrupt biological control. We were trying to embrace this concept of learning by doing, and this is a thing that Bob O'Neill, I believe, was kept on pounding into our heads, that you know that the way that people actually learn is by actually getting themselves involved in a new solution. And then we were hoping that by giving some of these home gardeners some basic concepts, they would be able to invent some of their solutions to their problems. And we were fortunate enough to get this thing funded by two USDA and CIPM grants, as well as some private money. So we developed this concept called ACORN. And you know, why ACORN? Well, actually, Bob O'Neill used to say that it was because we were nuts. But actually, it stands for the Alternative Control Outreach Research Network. And it's basically our idea that this was going to be a long-lived network, but as you well know, when the funding left, the interest, our ability to sustain it went down. But I think it's an interesting exercise that it was a network of master gardeners, extension educators, and researchers interested in reducing pesticide use in home gardens. We actually have a website that still is active that has all our basic training material on what biological control is and all about the slides that we use for our full-day training courses. And we had this day-long workshop where we introduced people about the concepts of biological control. We talked about experimentations. We gave people a chance to look at a lot of things. We developed some web-based backstopping that would allow the homeowners to, the master gardeners, to actually send their data to us via the web. Now, this was kind of interesting because when we were doing this, we actually got hacked by, I think, some sort of Chinese group at one point in time. And we were telling everybody, don't worry about being on the web, you know, it's fine. And we had these little hands-on exercises. And well, all of a sudden, one day we got hammered with all these emails because somebody, every time they logged onto our website, it said something like, F-U-S-A. So I can imagine after bribing these semi-retired gardeners into using this thing, it just sort of blew their wigs off. It was really not the way we wanted to do it, but they got over it, and after a couple of bottle of Maaloxes, so did I. But in the process, we developed this. This is kind of how we did. We would have natural enemy collections. Bob had this wonderful collection. I think he had the student from Argentina at one point in time in the laboratory who was collecting all these Jorge Frana, who was collecting all these parasitoids on caterpillars, and he would collect all these gregarious endoparasitoids, and they kind of looked like little flags. You would see the caterpillar, and then you'd see hundreds of parasites coming out of each caterpillar. And we had boxes of these things, and it would just really impress the living daylights out of the master gardeners that many parasites could come out of one little wasp. So we tried our best to really jazz up these people about biological control, and I think we did. We had live insects, and we actually had people staying. We had to kick them out the door, so that they really enjoyed it. We then, to my bias for liking to develop databases that people never use, developed this we call this an alternative control guide, which is basically an interactive web-based database that would allow people to search for pests based on the particular plant that they were working with. And we were focusing on vegetable gardens because it's a much smaller universe, where there would be photos of the insects and the crops. We characterized crops in terms of susceptibility to pests. We talked about different types of natural enemy profiles that could be used for different types of pests. We also suggested what kinds of resources you want to put into a garden in order to keep them there. So we were saying keep things diverse, have things flowering as much as you possibly can. And we had some state-specific recommendations. And this is online, and it's probably a little bit out of a date, but it's a fun concept. This idea was I borrowed from my neighbor Rick Foster, who's in the office right next to me. He put together this list of a very ingenious list of vegetable crops, which I really like, because what we use it to do is to illustrate to people that, you know, if you want to use have a garden that doesn't use pesticides, then just plant things that don't get pests. I mean, it's pretty simple. So on the left-hand side, he made a list of all the plants that, you know, people could grow in their garden without that just don't have a whole lot of pest pressures in the Midwest, and contrast that on the right, you know, broccoli, cabbage, you know, potato, squash, corn, that sort of thing. And, you know, that kind of simple concept was the kind of thing that we wanted to instill in people that they could actually do. So that's sort of a basic background of the kind of education that we gave some folks. But over a period of about 3 years, you know, Rob, Bob, and I trained about 225 people in small sessions in Indiana and in Illinois. And then what we did was we see. I like databases, but I can't even touch the computer without messing it up. This was the first phase, and the second phase was with Justin Vitullo, who's in the back over there. We tried to continue this with roses. So I'm going to talk a little about some of the research that we did with master gardeners. And the first thing that we had to do was to try and get people to think about experimenting. And, you know, I think initially our target was America's Master Gardener. I forget his name, but the fellow who's employed by Kmart. What? Jerry Baker. We wanted to sort of, you know, take him down with data, but that wasn't really going to work. But I thought this was one of the most creative things I've ever seen. This is called some kind of a motion-activated water scarecrow that's supposed to chase the rabbits away. So, you know, we'd show them pictures like this, and we'd get the group to talk together and trying to define a hypothesis, you know, what kind of hypothesis that you would want to test in order to see if this worked or not. You know, how would you measure it to see if it worked? You know, we talked about the importance of replication and comparing to control. And I think that probably the biggest limitation that we have with home gardeners is that they got a really small area to garden usually, and they don't really want to let that garden plot go for control. So, I kind of like seeing things completely chewed up, because then I know that what works really did work. But they don't work that way. So I think that might be one of the basic limitations that we might have. But I think that, you know, that said, I think that they do like to actually work with things. So then we tried to, you know, tell them how to accept or reject a hypothesis, and then we wanted to discuss their findings using a listserv that we had for the ACORN research group. And we tested quite a few things. We did some work on augmentation biological control using Trichogramma and Chrysopa larva. We did some work on conservation habitat modification, and you know, some of the stuff we actually were able to publish. I mean, Rob and I, we got this article on carabid communities in Indiana and in Illinois. We did some work with floating row covers, which we thought would be kind of interesting. We covered squash with floating row covers, and we found out that when it gets really hot in Indiana, people get belly aches from eating squash that is too hot, that's covered in a floating row cover, because it's something that the cucurbitacin concentration gets very, very high, and people will actually eat the bitter squash rather than throwing away. That must be something about, say something about gardeners. Which reminds me a story. I mean, we were in Chicago, and we asked people, we always would start our presentations, you know, why do you garden? And this one guy, he just nailed it. He says, he sort of had this, I think he had some kind of like an Irish or Scottish type of accent, and he says, I garden for the pure misery of it. And we thought, now that's a guy after our own heart. So we really, really, really enjoyed that guy. So, I mean, I love working with master gardeners, because they actually, you know, they like to putter around in gardens and talk about plants, and that's kind of what I like to do, so it's just a lot of fun. So here's some data, which I'm compelled to present, because this is a national meeting. And we found that that when we got people to release Trichogramma with cabbage worms inside plots, that we actually were able to reduce the populations of cabbage caterpillars to actually economic levels. Now, that's the good news. Bad news that, you know, probably cost them $30 to control each plant, but you know, at 19 cents a pound, you know, they did like the idea, and they learned that insects can actually control some pest problems. We did some work on mulch versus no mulch in potato, but I, for some reason, we never took a picture of that, Rob, but we had pictures of it. I mean, I couldn't find one in my files, because this actually predated the electronic versions of my files. And but we found that where there was no mulch, there were only 380 carabids in caught in pitfalls, whereas with mulch, there were like twice as many. So you know, changing the habitat really does affect things, and this is the kind of information that we would use to try and demonstrate to our master gardeners that what they do can actually affect populations. We did some work with lace wings, and part of the fun was we could get these little lace wing containers, and you know, if you ever want to show people lace wings, you put one of these things up on an overhead, and you can see them wiggling around, and everybody just goes wild with that. And so people like, you know, Mike, you're talking about how everybody likes to work doing all the hands-on sort of thing. This is just a great way, especially if you're stuck doing workshops at night, just to show them live insects, you know, wiggling them around. We did some work on weeding with snap beans. This is, I thought, we figured we wanted to try and increase the abundance of different kinds of organisms inside vegetable gardens. We thought, well, let's just see what happens if you don't weed for the first 6 weeks. Well, I'm even embarrassed to show what happened. Basically, the plants really, you know, got covered with the weeds and killed by the leafhoppers. So, you know, we decided that was a bad idea. So, I'm not even going to show that one over there. But we did have people let the garden go weedy, and now we know why people weed their gardens. We did some work with sugar spray, which was some of the work that Bob O'Neill had done with Luis Cañas for his actual dissertation work, where he was looking at what happens when you put sugar on corn in the tropics, and you actually can increase the natural enemy community and actually reduce populations of corn pests to a level that is actually acceptable in the tropics. On cabbage, what happens is that you have a lot of holy cabbage because it just doesn't really work. You get a lot more ants and a lot more parasites, but it just doesn't do the job. But it was a hypothesis that we tested, and the master gardeners can actually see that this stuff works. Okay, we did some stuff with Surround. Anybody ever work with Surround? It's that kale and clay stuff that you mix around, and you turn your beautiful green garden into something that looks like it was painted with a dilute white paint. It works to some extent, but most gardeners just don't like it because it makes the garden look ugly, so enough said. This is the famous floating row covers that gave people belly aches. I think that this has some potential for some other sorts of things, but this is a good example of mechanical type of control. So we played around in the garden, which was probably the main reason why I really got involved with it. In addition, we also were starting to change some of their behavior. Now, one of the things that we looked at was we wanted to see, you know, what kind of people were really in this sort of a project. And basically, we broke down to people. This is the yellow would be all the participants who we train, all 220 and some. These are the researchers would be the purple, and the blue would be the non-researchers. Are the purple and the blue are the researchers. And basically, we found that as a group, there wasn't much difference. Everybody would only, if in terms of putting pesticides, they would just target their pesticides just on the infected plant only, which I thought was really great, which says to me that at least they're not spraying their entire garden every time there's a problem. So they're somewhat sophisticated in terms of IPM principles. But interestingly, when we did a survey, a pre-survey, we wanted to find out, you know, what group of these people, what was their tolerance to insect injury? And we found that people who said that they used biological control, I'm not sure they knew what that meant, or they said they had no pest management, I don't think they could care less how much injury was on their plants. They could tolerate 25% more distortion, discoloration, or any kind of feeding. But anybody who said they managed their pests, either by using pesticides or pesticides and biological control, they had a bit of a lower tolerance. So I think that these people generally are kind of uneducated in the pest control, and these folks are just more educated than that. And we found that people who used pest control, biocontrol at least once before, there was an increase in adoption after participation in the program. Whoops. And probably the most interesting result was we found that those that researchers, okay, before had one level of adoption, and after they had another level of adoption. So we found that people who were involved in the research program had a much larger increase in their adoption of biological control than those who were not actually participating in the research. So the take-home point of this is that research is critical to get these people involved in trying to adopt new technology. And there's a book by Rogers called The Diffusion of Technologies. I think it comes out of Iowa. I think it was in Iowa. And he says that, you know, in order to get people to change technology, to adopt new technology, you have to get them involved in things. Okay, now. Great.
morphology and ecology, which makes it more serious insect, is that it vectors a bacterium, Candidatus Liberobacter asiaticus, which is responsible for citrus greening disease. It's a very serious disease that renders fruits unmarketable and can kill the disease tree within 5 to 10 years. This disease was identified from Florida in 2005 in South Florida, and as you can, if you see here, it's now spreading quickly throughout the state. If we see here in this map, in this corner, all the counties in red are the counties where the positive cases of greening are confirmed, and these pink dots on a large map are the individual locations where those cases were confirmed. So basically along both the coastlines and in the southwest and central region, the disease incidence is high. So to control the pest as well as the disease in the long run, both the biological and chemical means of control are required. There's a good biological control for these insects, particularly predatory lady beetles and a species-specific parasite, the Tamaraxia radiata, that was introduced. So judicious use of insecticide is required to maintain the ecological stability and the diversity of natural enemies. Systemic insecticides applied through soil avoid the direct contact and affecting the non-target organisms. Aldicarb is a systemic carbamate insecticide which is marketed under the trade name Tamic as a granular formulation. And it's recommended for use in Florida citrus at the rate of 33 pounds per acre. We work on these objectives because the major unanswered questions are related to the rate, placement, and timing of the product in Florida citrus. As I said, the recommended rate is 33 pounds per acre, but the sometimes growers use the reduced rates to save in cost. So we looked at the recommended rate and reduced rates. Then usually this product is applied in a continuous furrow on the bed side of the tree row or one side. But some growers, they do the split applications on both sides of the row, thinking that this practice may improve the control. Then previously, the application window, considering the dry season of Florida to avoid the leaching effects, its application window was between 1st January and 30th of April. And then because of the increased use of the product and the shortage of professional applicators, recently the start date was extended back to 15th of November. So, but it was not clear whether applying that early or at what time before the spring flash really impacts the psyllid population. And then as I said, it was important to look at the natural enemies also, and mainly I will present the data on the coccinellid lady beetles. So the first rate study in 2006 was done on a large block of Valencia oranges, 151 trees per acre on double row raised beds. It was a randomized complete block design, 4 reps and 4 treatments. There were 2 beds per plot. We looked at 3 rates, 33 pounds, 16.5 pounds, and 8.25 pounds. There was a control, and the applications were made only on the bed side, and the control received a blank application. Excuse me. Psyllid populations were monitored in April, May, and June, and that mainly depends on the production of flush, young flush, especially where the nymphal populations develop. Flush density was estimated using a quadrant frame of 0.13 meter square, and psyllid adults and predators were monitored by a tap sample, which basically is a white sheet of paper 8 by 11 inches placed on a clipboard, which is placed under the branches, and branches are tapped 3 times with the hand, and any falling individuals on the paper are counted. We also made 1 minute counts for the predator adults and larvae on the bed sides of the trees. 10 flushes were examined per tree for psyllid infestation, and eggs and nymphs were counted in the lab on one of the infested flush per tree. For this study and the other studies that I'll mention, treatments were made with the professional applicator, and in this case they were made on 8th of March at 2 to 3 feet distance from the tree trunks. We are looking at the effects of the treatments, and where you will not see these alphabets, that means there were no significant differences on these variables. And here we see that in May, there was significant treatment effect from all the 3 rates that reduced the adults numbers And we did see a rate response in June, and the most reduction was seen with the highest labor rate of 33 pounds per acre. In June, also there was a significant effect only from the highest labor rate that reduced the percentage of infested flush, and there were no effects on eggs, density of eggs and nymphs per flush in this study. The second study looked at the placement of these rates and on the bed side or on the bed and swale sides. Again, the trial was conducted in a large block. There were 12 years and 8-year-old orange trees of Hamelin. There were four reps, each divided into seven plots, each a single double row bed. The same three rates that we used in the previous study, but in this case, each rate was applied in two separate treatments. In one treatment, it was applied only on the one side of the trees, and in the other treatment, it was split application both on the bed and swale side, the two sides of the trees. And then there was an untreated control that received a blank application. Psyllid populations were monitored in May and June. One small and one large trees were sampled per plot, both on the bed and swale sides. The other procedures were similar to the previous study. We did not see any significant effects of placement either on the bed or swale side. There were no differences between these two treatments or of tree age, because we looked at the 12 years and 8-year-old trees. So I am presenting the pool data for the rate effects here. And again, we see that there was a treatment effect on adults. Numbers were reduced with all the three rates, but the highest labor rate was most effective. Again, there were effects on the percentage of